Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You're not going to believe this, so I'm just going to give it to you straight. The big banks that got billions in bailouts during the financial crisis, now they're going to get tax refunds, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Deluxe Corp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking. Deluxe.com. And by MassMutual, offering retirement and 401k plans to businesses for more than 60 years. MassMutual.com/retirestrong.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 24th of March, and it is good, as always, to have you here. To explain the bank refund story today, we need to back up a little bit. The stimulus package that was signed last year had a lot of things mixed in with that $787 billion. About a third of it was tax cuts. Some of those tax cuts were set aside for companies that lost money and desperately needed stimulus. Those companies would then be allowed to make up for some of the money that they had lost by not having to pay as much to Uncle Sam, clearly aimed at companies that took a beating during the financial crisis. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains what's actually happening.
J.P. Morgan Chase managed to escape the worst of the financial crisis relatively unscathed. But in those dark days, the bank snapped up rival Washington Mutual. J.P. Morgan had to write down billions of dollars in losses because of the deal. And now it's trying to use its WaMu purchase to collect a tax refund worth about $1.4 billion.
J.P. Morgan is a fool not to pick up this refund if it's being offered to all comers.
Bart Narder is a banking analyst with Celent. He says you can't fault J.P. Morgan for taking advantage of a tax break that hundreds of other companies are getting, including other banks. But he says the tax break had absolutely no impact on J.P. Morgan's decision to buy WaMu.
They got all sorts of other government support when they picked up Washington Mutual, including guarantees from the FDIC. This just makes the deal all the much sweeter for J.P. Morgan.
Now, an extra $1.4 billion at J.P. Morgan might eventually seep out into the economy and stimulate something. But Steve Ellis of Taxpayers for Common Sense says, who can be sure they'll lend the money out?
It's a pretty poor return on investment because there's no guarantee that they're going to do anything that is economically stimulative. They can pay down debt. They can hoard cash. It really doesn't have any strings attached to it whatsoever. And so it's really turned out to be an economic loser as far as stimulus.
The tax breaks may be more useful for some of the other recipients. U.S. Airways will get a break. Same with Borders, Zales Jewelry, and several home builders. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The Post Office delivered an announcement today that really shouldn't come as much of a surprise. The U.S. Postal Service formally proposed cutting back mail delivery to just 5 days a week. If regulators and Congress approve, getting rid of Saturday deliveries will save as much as $3 billion a year. Big users of the mails, mainly junk mailers, are reluctantly on board, as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Thanks largely to the Internet, the volume of paper mail has shrunk by nearly a quarter since 2006. And as a result, the mail service has lost a lot of money. And Postal Vice President Sam Pulcrano says in the next decade, it could lose another $238 billion.
One of the opportunities to significantly close that gap is to convert from six-day to five-day delivery.
The Mailers Council represents bulk users of the post office. They make up 70% of the overall volume. Chairman Jim O'Brien says they've been resigned to a Saturday cutback for a long time.
As volume declines, you have less and less money to justify your network. So the way that you improve revenue per stop is to reduce your delivery days.
Still, O'Brien says eliminating Saturday deliveries will force hundreds of newspapers, magazines, and catalogs to shift their production schedules. At a Senate hearing last week, Postmaster General John Potter admitted the cutbacks could send bulk users looking for other delivery services.
We have to keep our price competitive. And so, yes, something will be lost as a result of moving from 6 to 5 day delivery. But I look at what's being protected. What's being protected is the 150 billion pieces of mail that we anticipate being in the system.
The delivery cuts would mean layoffs for 50,000 part-time letter carriers. If Congress approves the plan, the Postmaster General says there will be a six-month transition period before Saturday mail deliveries go the way of the Pony Express. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Once all of its line items go into effect a couple of years from now, the health care bill that President Obama signed yesterday will force almost everybody to have health insurance or face a series of penalties. More than a dozen states have already filed suit to stop that from happening. They say the federal government just can't force people to buy insurance. While the courts chew on that, we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer how those penalties might work and whether they'll be effective at all.
Starting in 2014, most Americans will have to pay a penalty of $95 if they decide not to buy health insurance. Considering the average premium is about $4,000 a year, the penalty isn't a bad deal. At least that's what Matthew Kuhl thinks.
I'd probably pay the fine.
Kuhl is a healthy 25-year-old. He owns a small landscaping company in Oakland, California, and doesn't have insurance.
I probably could afford health insurance, but right now, in my mind, I'm a young, healthy, active person, so it doesn't seem like it's worth it right now.
Matthew Kuhl is the insurance industry's nightmare. Insurers need people who pay their premiums but use very little care. They balance out the cost of covering the sicker people, like the millions with pre-existing conditions that insurers will soon have to cover. But here's the thing. The penalties for not having insurance go up over time. Under the bill President Obama signed yesterday, by 2016, someone who opted out would pay $750 or 2% of their income, whichever was greater. That gets Matthew Kuhl's attention.
When the fees go up, I'd probably be forced to jump on board.
Until then, Kuhl will live the uninsured lifestyle. No more motorcycle, no skateboard, and no overseas travel. Kuhl knows if he ends up in the emergency room, he'll be stuck with the bill. Barack Richman is a health law expert at Duke University. He says people who choose to be uninsured may not know what they're getting into.
Individuals without lots of data do not make smart calculations about small risks.
Richman says huge bills for emergency room care can lead to financial ruin. And there's another thing. Uninsured people often don't see a doctor until they're really sick. Karen Davis is president of the Commonwealth Fund. She says chronic conditions like high blood pressure and diabetes aren't discovered and treated early on. That ends up costing all of us.
These chronic conditions account for over 60% of all health care costs. So to find those chronic conditions or risk factors very early on does have long-run savings.
Even though it's hard to think of the long run when you're 25 and invincible. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On the theory that there is never a dull moment in Washington, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs made a daring prediction today. Now that health care is done, Gibbs said, the president expects financial reform to be wrapped up in the next couple of months. That's a quote, next couple of months is what Gibbs said. We'll let you know how that goes. Yesterday, it was existing home sales that disappointed. Today, it's the new ones. They fell for the fourth month in a row to their lowest point since 1963. Part of that, analysts said, was the lousy weather much of the country had, but part of it was just a plain lousy market. In the 107-year-old fixer-upper at the corner of Wall Street and Broad in Lower Manhattan today, traders pretty much gave up on that two-day rally they had been enjoying. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's springtime in Arizona, and the smell of cheap real estate is in the air. Investors with cash on hand have been snatching up thousands of foreclosed homes. Many of those digging up the bargains are Canadians who have the American Southwest in their crosshairs. From KJZZ in Phoenix, Peter O'Dowd tells us why.
The weather here is gorgeous this time of year, especially for Canadians fed up with winter. But according to realtor Greg Swan, that's just one of the many reasons Canadians are circling over the casualties of Arizona's real estate crisis.
Canadians are good at saving money. They just are. Or at least the Canadians who are coming down here to buy real estate have cash, and they have lots of it.
One of Swan's cash buyers just flew in from Vancouver to tour a few houses in foreclosure outside of Phoenix. The buyer's name is Bill Chipman, and he's the president of a startup called REI Corp Capital.
So we've got high ceilings in this one.
Yeah. This is the lavender floor plan. I love this floor plan as a rental.
The asking price is $97,000. That's less than half of what it was a few years ago. The entire region is scarred with empty houses just like this.
Do we need carpet?
I think it's fine.
I think
it just needs to be cleaned.
Clean the carpet.
Chipman says this is an investment opportunity of a lifetime. He and his partners are raising $30 million to buy 500 houses in Phoenix, Las Vegas, and San Antonio. He says a favorable exchange rate and a housing market that's actually appreciating back home have put Canadians in a unique position to buy.
When people talk about recession up in British Columbia, we say, what recession? Never saw it. Our dollar's getting stronger. Our jobs are increasing. We're very optimistic in Canada.
That optimism has driven investments in the Phoenix area. According to the real estate research firm, The Information Market, sales to Canadians have jumped 80% compared to the same period a year ago. Bill Chipman says Canadian companies are mobilizing investors, sweeping up everything from townhomes to commercial strip malls.
We don't look at ourselves particularly as a bunch of vultures. We look at ourselves as rational investors that see a very good opportunity.
It's not just the big-shot investors who see the opportunity. School teachers and retirees are buying second homes in the American Southwest. And hey, who can blame them? Not when hot tubs and golf course views come at such a bargain. Maureen Porter just sold this hot tub and the house that goes with it to a client from Ontario.
You can sit out there at night, enjoy the stars. It's an amazing opportunity. They're thrilled about it. They're really excited.
Porter and her husband, Arnold, are Canadian citizens. They're local investors and real estate agents who cater exclusively to their fellow countrymen. Their website, Arizona for Canadians, is designed with a strange combination of cactus and maple leaves.
And we speak Canadian. We say A, so they understand that we know what they're saying.
The Porters say it's been difficult for their clients to get American financing for their investments. That hasn't mattered much, since most of them pay cash. But Arnold Porter says he sees more Canadians leveraging their home equity to buy houses in the U.S., and that's sort of what got Americans into this mess in the first place.
I think the money will be safe down here. But if they're borrowing too much money up there to do it, they're getting too aggressive in their thinking, I think there could be risk there.
At these prices, though, Arnold Porter says it doesn't matter who you are. Big investor or small potatoes, the opportunity for cheap real estate and sunshine is hard to pass up. In fact, he says he and his wife are thinking of buying a few more houses of their own. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
And now, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial sliced off 52 points today, nearly a 0.5%, ended at 10,836. The NASDAQ carved away 16 points, 0.2%, finished at 2398. The S&P 500 whittled off 6 points, a 0.5%, closed at 1167. While the Senate kept debating some fixes to the new health care law, some insurance stocks kept heading south. Aetna gave up 1.2% today. United Health He's down 1.3%. Cigna signed away 1.5% today. Shares of Genzyme, which makes drugs to treat rare and chronic diseases, fell 6.3% today. That followed word that the Food and Drug Administration plans to take enforcement action at one of Genzyme's plants. The dollar gained against the euro. That in turn pushed commodities lower. Chevron drained off more than 1%. ExxonMobil lost 0.2% today. Price on the 10-year T-note sank some, nudged the yield up to 3.85%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org. By Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. President Obama talks about health insurance reform at the University of Iowa. A House committee examines the impact of the government's foreclosure prevention efforts. Special focus will be on the Home Affordable Modification Program. And a little respect, Aretha Franklin turns 68. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. President Obama goes back into healthcare campaign mode tomorrow. He's going to make a trip out to Iowa to try to increase public support for the changes that he signed into law yesterday. Commentator Robert Reich was a strong supporter of the president's attempt to overhaul the healthcare system. He just thinks we need to be realistic about what we got and what we didn't.
Don't believe anyone who tells you the president's new healthcare legislation marks a swing of the pendulum back toward great society and New Deal programs like Medicare and Social Security. The basic idea behind Medicare and Social Security was for government to be the insurer. Citizens make payments to the government, and government gives out benefits. If the new legislation built on this idea, it would have made Medicare available to everyone, or at least provided a public insurance option. But the guiding principle of the new healthcare legislation draws from a different philosophy, first championed by Republican Presidents Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon, government as regulator of a private insurance market. Eisenhower took the first step in the 1950s by locking in the tax break for employer-provided health insurance. Nixon then pushed for a system of prepaid competing health plans, which ultimately became HMOs. Nixon also wanted to require all employers to cover their employees. President Obama has implemented these ideas and taken them a step further by requiring all Americans to carry health insurance and giving subsidies to those who need it. This does mark a swing of the pendulum, but really only back to before the 1980s, when President Reagan asserted that government was the problem rather than the solution, and the nation embarked upon almost four decades of deregulation and privatization. The American public still distrusts government. But in recent years, it has also become wary of health insurers that seem more interested in making money than ensuring good health care, as well as giant Wall Street investment banks willing to risk the entire economy on their own lucrative bets, and mortgage lenders and credit card companies that don't always tell us what we need to know. This week's vote in Washington does not signal a return to the New Deal or the Great Society, but it does suggest an end to the opposite extreme, an era when we trusted that an unfettered market would always do what's right.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. You can write to us and share your thoughts no matter where you work. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. As long as we're on the health care bill, by the way, it's worth a mention that at 2,300-something pages long, we are still finding out exactly what's in the thing. Yesterday, it was that bit about chain restaurants having to post calorie counts for all their menu items. Today, it's who on Capitol Hill is covered by the changes in the law and who is not. Erica Lovely had the story in Politico this morning. Erica, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
So explain this to me. What's going on here?
So basically, this is a carve-out in the health care bill that creates a two-tiered system for congressional staffers. Some staffers that work for some of the upper-level offices, like leadership or on the committees, are getting the option of keeping their old health insurance, whereas other staffers that work for personal offices actually have to go, like the rest of America, and get their insurance under President Obama's new law. It was originally thought that everyone was going to be covered under the president's health insurance plan, but it looks like from the legislation that that's not the case.
Yeah, and as we heard many times during this debate, Congress has a pretty good health plan, right?
Yeah, they do. And, you know, that's one point that staffers are bringing up. You know, there's not necessarily any reason why they would want to give it up.
So just to clarify here, let's say somebody works for Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House, a leadership role. She could conceivably keep her coverage, that staffer. But a staffer who works for Nancy Pelosi, representative from San Francisco, would have to jump into the exchange, right?
That's right. And that's where the difference lies. Essentially, those personal office staffers, you know, the people that are really keeping the congressional office going, would have to jump into the exchange. But the people who have the perkier jobs, basically, the ones that are working on committees, or if they're working for the leadership office, you know, that could be House Minority Leader Boehner or anyone else, would get this option. And essentially, the staffers are upset because because the feeling up here really is that, you know, if you're going to help produce legislation, you really should have to live by it.
And do you think it's an accident that the committee staffers that helped write the law get to keep their insurance?
You know, at this point, that's really unclear. Speaking to staffers in Pelosi's office, they essentially said that, yes, you know, they do realize that the committee staffers are exempt, but as far as why that happened, you know, it's not really clear. They're not talking about it. But I can assure you that in the coming weeks, Republicans are certainly going to probably press them further to get more details on that. In fact, Senator Grassley just last night introduced an amendment to the bill that would cause all staffers on the congressional level, all members of Congress, and even White House officials, so that would be the president, the vice president, to also be covered under the exchange. So again, it's kind of hitting home that point. If you make a law, if you make legislation, you should have to live by it.
Erica Lovely covers Congress for Politico. Erica, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The euro hit a 10-month low against the dollar today. Amazingly enough, for those who've been keeping up with the single currency, Greece had nothing to do with it. Fitch, the ratings agency, downgraded Portuguese government debt today. There is yet another big meeting in Brussels tomorrow where European leaders will try to figure out what to do about their debt problems and the stability of the euro, if they can stop squabbling, that is. From the Marketplace European Desk in London, Stephen Beard reports.
On the eve of the summit, EU leaders are still bickering over a bailout for Greece. The French favour a rescue by the eurozone itself, but Germany would have to foot most of the bill. German hostility to that idea will have deepened after Portugal's downgrade, says analyst Graham Mather.
The Portuguese problems are a warning that if you start bailing out one country with taxpayers' money from Germany, you may end up bailing out several others.
The Germans would rather the Washington-based International Monetary Fund stepped in. But a senior official in the European Central Bank said today that would undermine the euro. It would show Europe unable to keep its own house in order. Currency strategist Steve Barrow doesn't envy the EU leaders meeting in Brussels tomorrow.
EU ministers are between a rock and a hard place here. I don't think there's an easy solution, and probably not a solution that's likely to lead to any significant strength for the euro.
He says the single currency is almost certainly headed lower. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
. 2009 wasn't a whole lot of fun for most companies in the retail business. For those of us on the other side of the transaction, though, it was pretty good. If you knew where to look, there were some deals to be had. Discount retailers like TJ Maxx and Nordstrom Rack had shelves that were packed with all the great stuff that full-price stores couldn't get rid of. But the economy's a little bit better now. Retailers are a little bit smarter. So discounters are having to get more creative, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
Last year, nobody paid full price for anything. Why would they? You could find Coach bags at Ross Dress for Less and Juicy Couture hoodies at Marshalls.
Oh, sure, you could pay that crazy boutique price. Or get the same bag right now at TJ Maxx for up to half off. How? Simple.
Really simple. Department stores and boutiques were loaded down with stuff they couldn't sell. They slashed prices, then slashed them again. Still no sales. So retailers cut their losses and unloaded their merchandise. Discounters bought top-shelf brands by the truckload, and frugal shoppers picked up Prada at JCPenney prices. Bert Flickinger is a retail analyst with Strategic Resource Group.
2009 was the best year in recorded retail history for most of the discount and off-price players.
But discounters and outlets won't be able to count on runoff from the big retail chains this year. Matthew Katz is a retail consultant with Alex Partners. He says big department stores and other brand name retailers have cut inventory way back.
The mainstream retailers very quickly shut the spigot off and stopped ordering product. What all of the full price stores are trying to do is minimize the excess.
Katz says since the recession, $25 billion worth of merchandise has vanished from store shelves, just as the number of off-price stores has shot up. Nordstrom and Saks opened dozens of outlets last year. Bloomingdale's is launching its first outlets this summer. online luxury discounters like Gilt and Bluefly have exploded. Lawrence Kosick heads up online discounter Row 9. He says competition for prime retail runoff is fierce.
You have to be careful that you find something that's not readily available in other places, and that's harder and harder to do, quite admittedly.
Kosick says for smaller retailers, that means finding a niche. Row 9 focuses on big-name sunglasses, handbags, and jewelry. Larger discounters are taking another tack.
We'll go directly to the designer and work with them on creating products specifically for our off-fifth customer.
Rob Wallstrom is president of Saks Off Fifth. He says these days, leftovers from Saks Fifth Avenue only make up about 20% of his outlet's merchandise.
A little less product is flowing through to us, but we do not have any lack of supply because they're creating it for us.
Analyst Matthew Katz says lots of outlets are now operating more like full-price stores, bringing in merchandise tailored to their customers and recognizing that they're brands of their own now.
They'll have to get smart about trends. In the recent past, they've been buying on what has been built and then using that as their selling tools. Today, they're going to have to act with a little bit more foresight.
And designers, whose products ended up in outlets only if they didn't sell at full price or had a strange stain on them, are creating looks especially for discounters. After all, that's where a lot of their customers are now. A survey from Strategic Resource Group found 80% of shoppers who had crossed over to discounters during the recession say they plan to stay there. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Trusted Choice Independent Insurance Agents, offering a choice of companies and coverage. You can find a local agent at 1-800-WE-INSURE. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by Putnam Investments, helping investors save for retirement since 1937. For the latest retirement news, you can talk to your advisor, then visit RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, the healthcare debate may be officially over with, but the politics of it linger on. When Democrats decided to use budget reconciliation to move the healthcare bill forward, Republicans said there would be a price to pay. The Senate is a place that runs on what's called unanimous consent for most procedural things. Everybody has to agree. Well, this morning, GOP senators withheld that agreement on a rule about committee hearings, so everything came to a screeching halt at 2 o'clock. Witnesses stopped mid-testimony, the whole deal. Quitting time, I guess. Speaking of which, a look at the clock here tells me that we got to go. That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 52 points. That's 0.5%. The NASDAQ down 16 points, 2/3 of 1%. The S&P 500 fell 6 points. That is 0.5%. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson, Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program, roads in our lives and in the economy.
A road is an intention sort of made real, isn't it? I mean, we spend all this money, all this time to build the road. And what does it do? It disappears in our rearview mirror.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.